the ability to use genomic information to improve selection and prediction of breeding populations is going to get better and better. And I say this both for sort of what we think of as major effect loci and also for maybe minor effect loci as well.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Grow a carbon crop below your row crop. Add carbon to your balance sheet with Loam Bio. Revenue grew, so did your hours. The owner's box, buy back 20 a week. Stop hiring for problems automation can solve. Start with Elevate Agents. Don't hire another VA stuck in 2015. Hire a remote AI specialist from Latin who runs AI tools, works in your time zone, and helps your team move faster. Schedule your free strategy call at www.wisevas.io. Zentrix OS, the business operating system built for teams who are serious about goals, tasks, and measurable results. One platform to run your entire operation. Zentrix Insights, the right person in the right seat starts with knowing how your team is actually wired. Visit ZentrixInsights.com.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Leo Bastos, Assistant Professor of Integrative Precision Agriculture at the University of Georgia. Today, we welcome our guest, Dr. Bob Stupar. Bob, welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show. It's really great to have you here with us today. And I want to start things here by asking you if you can share with us a little bit about your background, your position, where you are, and how you got there.
Okay, great. Yeah. Thanks, Leonardo. I really appreciate being here today. I really appreciate the invitation, having a chance to talk to you and talk to your audience. My background, I'm currently at the University of Minnesota. I'm a professor in the Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics. And I grew up in about 6 hours drive from here in a area of the upper Midwest of the United States, suburb of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is near Lake Michigan. And I came to the University of Minnesota as an undergraduate. And I was kind of at that stage of my life, uncertain about what kind of career path I might have. I eventually gravitated toward biology without really knowing exactly what I wanted to do with it. And when I was a senior in my senior year of college, I did an assignment where I had to write a paper about that involved plant breeding, which is something that I wasn't super familiar with. But as part of the assignment, I came and interviewed a professor in this department, actually the one that I'm currently employed by, named Dr. Don Rasmussen. He was a barley breeder at the University of Minnesota at that time. And so I interviewed him, and he really piqued my interest in this field because I was very interested in genetics, and I was very interested in sort of helping people and finding ways to make the world a better place. And plant breeding sounded like a really wonderful direction to take for that sort of career and having those values. And so about a year later, I started my graduate work in the plant breeding and plant genetics department the program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I worked there for Jiming Zhang. He led the potato breeding program, but he was also did a lot of sort of chromosome biology and basic molecular genetics of crops type of work. So I got exposed to the breeding program, and I also learned a lot of sort of this newish field known as genomics while I was a graduate student. I returned to Minnesota for a postdoc with Nathan Springer's lab. Nathan's work at that time, he was a newer professor, and we were looking at sort of the molecular questions that underlie heterosis in maize. So I got a new opportunity to work on a totally different system, a totally different question, looking mostly at gene expression and how it might influence inbred variation and how hybrids come together to perform sort of increased yield and performance compared to their parents. And then I was able to, just through a matter of luck, a position here in the department across the street opened up. I applied for it, and it focuses on legume crops. So the genomics and genetics of legume crops, which in Minnesota is primarily soybean. We also do have some work in field pea as well. But I've mostly been working on soybean for the last, I guess, 18 plus years now in this position. And I also should mention I have a teaching appointment in the department. So I'm a 75% research, 25% teaching appointment. So I teach the plant genomics and plant genetics courses primarily for graduate students. And then I also have my research program, which is mostly a molecular biology / biotechnology type of program that's focusing mainly on the genetics and what genes, the important genes that are involved in different traits in soybean.
Fantastic. Thanks for sharing that. It's a really cool path in terms of, you know, that your career, being influenced so much by a professor that was in the department that you are currently today. So that must be really exciting to see that play out.
Yeah, it's kind of shocking looking back at it. Usually you don't have that many opportunities. You know, I should mention, I interviewed for 3 different faculty positions at different places across the U.S. during my postdoc time, and I was not able to get those jobs. But then I happened to find one that was local where I already was, so that was great for lots of reasons. But yeah, nice. Sometimes you get lucky, and there's some serendipity involved as well.
That's true. That's right. Fantastic. Well, so you mentioned here a few different terms, right? So you mentioned plant genetics, genomics, and also want to throw in there biotechnology. Can you explain to us perhaps what's the difference? What are the similarities across those different terms, and what do they mean? How they're different?
Yeah, that's a great question. And they are all sort of interrelated in different ways, but they are distinct. And so I would just start with genetics as a term. It's kind of the oldest of the three, I guess. It's been around a long time to describe, you know, mostly what we see, what inheritance is, and something that we've known about as, you know, humans for as long as we've been around. We can see the basics of genetic inheritance from parent to offspring. But the study of genetics really focuses mostly on the inheritance of those traits and those phenotypes. And, you know, it was really the early 20th century where Mendel's laws were rediscovered. And so we started to really understand the structure of genetics and how traits can be somewhat predictable in the way they segregate among offspring and populations. So we've known about the formal study of genetics has been around for quite some time. Genomics is a more recent, I would say, field, and it's really focused more on the DNA sequence and the genes that underlie these traits. So it's understanding when we say the genome, we're really referring to all the genes that are present in an organism. So, for example, in soybean, we have about approximately 50,000 genes, and you might be, and these things encode primarily proteins. They're strands of DNA that encode proteins, and we're just starting to scratch the surface and understanding exactly how variation in those genes causes the variation in traits that we say use in our breeding selection criteria. But it's interesting that plant genomes are pretty fascinating for lots of reasons. I just mentioned soybean has about 50,000 genes. That's approximately twice as much as humans have, which is a little bit surprising to a lot of people. The complexity of the organism doesn't exactly relate to the number or amount of DNA or the amount of genes we have. And some plants have even much more, much larger genomes. Wheat, for instance, has about 4 times as much as a human would have in terms of the total number of genes. But the field of genomics and the way I look at it is really understanding which parts of these genes, where DNA sequence variation matters, I guess is really the question we ask. Not only which gene is functioning and what does it do for the biology of the organism, but also what kind of variation in these genes drives the types of variation we see in breeding populations or just in nature. It's really interesting because if you compare any two soybean plants, for instance, any two varieties, there's probably maybe a million different DNA sequence changes that are different from one to the next. But the vast majority of them don't have any impact on the actual fitness or the performance of the organism. But there's a few that can have very important impacts, and that's why we see Maybe they have different flower colors. Maybe they have different plant heights. Maybe they have different yield potential. Maybe they have differential susceptibility to pathogens or pests, things like that. So the job, I think, to some extent, if we really distill it down, the job of genomics is to try to figure out what DNA sequence changes or regulation changes cause these phenotypic differences. So genetics kind of leads into genomics. Genetics is really about the traits and the phenotypes. Genomics is really about what causes those traits and phenotypes. And then biotechnology is another step on that path where we would actually try to use that information about what we know about genes and what's important about them and the DNA sequence changes that are important about them, and then try to apply that information to crop improvement. And so biotechnology is using things like, moving genes from one species to another, which we, conventionally known as GMOs or genetically modified organisms. But in modern times, it also implies things like gene editing. You maybe heard of CRISPR technology, where you don't bring a new gene in. Instead, you sort of try to change a DNA sequence in a very subtle way that might give you a favorable outcome in terms of the traits of interest. And even more broadly, you could loop in things that have been around for longer, like mutation breeding, where you try to induce new mutations to find new traits and things like that. So I would say biotechnology is really the application of some of the things we learned in genetics and genomics. But also, genomics also doesn't just lead to biotechnology, it also leads to conventional plant breeding outcomes as well. So I think genetics and genomics both lead to both paths of either conventional plant breeding or biotechnology outcomes for crop improvement.
Fantastic. That was such a great explanation. So I'm not a plant breeder. I probably took a couple of classes 10 years ago or so in my undergrad. So it was really good refresher of what those mean, those differences. Thanks for explaining that. And then if we follow up on that, so you're talking about how all these three areas of genetics, genomics, and biotechnology have been used and continue to be used and continue to evolve in terms of creating new genotypes that can perform better, right? So I wanted to ask you, if you can share with us, what are some of those tangible outcomes that have been generated through these technologies that we see, today in our varieties and perhaps elsewhere?
Yeah, it's a great question. Sort of the practical outcomes of how you can use these in crop improvement, is that
correct? Yep. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, genetics is as old as plant breeding, I would say. at least purposeful modern plant breeding, the ability to understand traits and select for them properly in a way is the basics of plant breeding. And that historically, if you go far enough back, that was done entirely based on just the phenotype of the plants, selecting, trying to come up with selection schemes or population schemes that would find the best individuals in a population most efficiently and then advancing those. So that's just pure genetics. And then I think in the last probably 25 years, we've seen a really big integration of genomics into that selection platform. So in the olden times, back when I was younger, there was still, and there still is a lot of phenotypic only selection, but some traits are very hard to select for just on phenotype alone. So imagine, for instance, you're a breeder and you're selecting for, I'm just going to throw a trait out there, like soybean cyst nematode or something like that. You need to have a proper environment in order to test for that sort of thing. But in the era of genomics, there's been a lot learned about finding DNA markers that are linked to the genes that confer resistance to a disease or a pathogen like that or a pest. So what breeders can do is they can use those markers instead, DNA markers that will predict the phenotype, and they can sort of enrich their populations to select for those phenotypes, usually fairly early on in the selection cycle. And then they can do the more complex traits with phenotypic selection later on in the pipeline. And so I think genomics has really enabled a more efficient selection of a lot of different types of traits. I bring up like diseases and pests, for instance, just because those are a lot of times conferred by fewer genes. So you can actually use a small number of markers to sometimes effectively select for those things, the resistance types that you desire. But what's happening really more and more over the years is that as genomics has grown and we've gotten a better understanding of genome diversity, breeders have been able to integrate what they call selection of like genome-wide markers, or sometimes they call it genomic selection, where they take lots and lots of markers and they just model how those markers behave or how they influence the trait behavior. So you can model what high yield might look like in a certain population based on markers, or you could model how low yield might look in a population based on markers. And so then they can build these models to select and predict even complex traits using the genome information. So we see this more and more in breeding these days, where markers allow breeders to perhaps maybe the best way to look at it is you can remove a lot of the stuff that you know is not going to be good. And you can enrich your populations for things that have the probability of being good using markers as a way to pre-screen your material before you go into the more in-depth and maybe expensive phenotyping platforms. So I would say that's how genomics and breeding interact in terms of crop improvement. And then biotechnology is sort of its own entity in some ways, because a lot of times there are very specific traits that a breeder wants to be able to bring in, and it's hard to, or maybe sometimes impossible to bring in through the native germplasm that they're using. So the most famous example is weed resistance or herbicide resistance genes for weed control. So that's, you know, in soybean, that's been the major trait from biotechnology for, I guess it's probably 30 years now. And so that's a trait that can be enhanced through the introgression of a transgene, but can't really be crossed in through conventional means. And so that's been around for a long time. And most, at least in a place like Minnesota, state of Minnesota, almost all the soybeans that are grown in the landscape here have some sort of herbicide resistance gene or gene package associated with it. But there's also the potential to bring in other traits as well through biotechnology. And now in the era of gene editing, it really opens the door for the possibilities of influencing lots of different traits using that sort of gene editing platform. And it really, and to some extent, it comes down to the economics of whether or not that trait is valuable enough to want to bring in through biotechnology.
Fantastic. So something that as you were explaining, I was thinking here is, as these technologies have evolved and these fields have evolved over time, what has been the impact of, you know, so starting with plant genetics and conventional breeding, and then bringing genomics and then bringing biotechnology, what has been the lag time? Perhaps that's not the best way to ask this, but what has been the time that it takes from starting a breeding program for a given trait until you start releasing varieties or hybrids in the market? How have those technologies shaped this duration that it takes to develop something new?
Yeah, I'm not really an expert on this because I don't run my own breeding program. I work very closely with Aaron Lorenz's group, who runs the soybean breeding program at the University of Minnesota. And of course, I'm part of a community where there's lots of soy public and private sector soybean breeders involved. So I don't feel entirely qualified to give a good answer to this question, but I'll give a very qualitative answer to this question. I think it speeds up the cycle of selection. I think that the ability to use markers in genomic selection, for instance, it speeds up their cycles of selection, so they can evaluate more material more quickly and identify new parents more quickly for their breeding programs. But in terms of how fast that speeds up a product delivery, I think it speeds it up. I can't quantify how many like years in total that ends up, you know, changing the game.
Yeah. No, fantastic.
I'm afraid that has to be, you have to ask a breeder that question. <Yeah. laughs> I've seen presentations on it, and I think it also depends on what species you're working on. Because if you're an apple breeder, it's going to be very different than if you're working on an annual crop, for instance. So I don't have a really good answer for that one.
No, that makes great sense. And really, you know, this was one question that I was just thinking through as you were explaining. So, yeah, so it makes sense that my wild question here perhaps didn't fall within what your direct expertise is, but I still wanted to give you a shot.
No, I appreciate that. Yeah, it's a good question.
So we talked a little bit about here. One of the main traits that have been developed here being that herbicide resistance against herbicide use on these row crops. Are there any other examples that perhaps are not as popular in terms of just the general population to be aware of them, that would be another good example of how genomics have helped this process of bringing new traits into crops?
I think one nice example might be, I kind of go back to soybean cyst nematode, because I think that's at least in the soybean world, that's an extremely important issue. Biologically, the molecular biology of resistance is a pretty interesting story, because there's multiple resistance genes that have been mapped for soybean cyst nematode using, you know, genetic and genomic technologies. But what people have discovered in recent years is these different resistance genes on different chromosomes seem to interact with one another. In other words, certain combinations confer best case scenarios, whereas other combinations, which you might predict at face value to be good, will not be. So there's some empirical information that's been built up about how these different genes interact with each other. You know, we call that the epistasis, the way the genes may kind of confer in combination confer some sort of outcome. And so, you know, it reminds me of in graduate school, we had a professor in plant pathology who was fond of saying, you know, no gene acts alone. Like as a genomicist, we always want to sort of make this question as simple as possible and figure out what a gene does. But a lot of times what a gene does is really dependent on the context of the environment and the context of the other genes that are present in a given situation. So I think soybean cyst nematode, there's been some really cool studies there where it's sort of, we're starting to unlock that puzzle a little bit to figure out what genes can be used in combination in certain ways to confer resistance to different strains and different races of the pest. So that's one example. And then there's, in biotechnology, there's several other genes that have been deployed for certain traits certainly in corn, there's different types of biotech stacks that have been developed for different types of pests and herbicide resistance in combination. And we've seen a little bit of that developed in soybean as well.
Nice. Fantastic. So my next question to you here is, so you have led a 5-year strategic planning process for the soybean genomics community. And so my question is, could you tell us a little bit about why this was done and what were the major goals of that effort?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this, I would say, is the third leg of my job, which I don't have a formal appointment in, but we have teaching, we have research, and we also have service. And I'd say to some extent, this is the service side of what we do. And so how do we make the community better? How do we use and impact what we're doing to, you know, the service is a broad definition. It can be with respect to the farmers, with respect to the scientific community, you know, reviewing papers, the peer review process, all that stuff falls under this. But what you're describing and asking about is really a unique thing. It's in the soybean community, every approximately 5 years, we form a strategic plan. And this is specific to the genomics community. I should be specific about that. So it's actually a 5-year plan, a strategic plan that we make just for the genomics, and as it overlaps with breeding in other fields as well. But so there's a committee called the Soybean Genomics Executive Committee that is responsible for doing two things. Number one is that every 2 years they put on a biennial conference for cellular and molecular biology of soybean, and the other thing they do is a 5-year strategic plan. And so the goal of the strategic plan is mostly to summarize accomplishments that have been done over the past or the previous 5 years, and then identify new opportunities and areas of priority for the next 5 years. So in the case of our most recent strategic plan, we brought together a group of scientists from around the country, and we all discussed and we put them in priority areas. So like the pests and pathogens group would talk about emerging pests and pathogens that we need to be thinking about and working on as a community. The plant breeding group would got together and talked about new plant breeding methodologies that can be developed by the community for certain outcomes. And so there's like, I think there's five or six groups that sort of split up and work together into these sections to create accomplishments and priorities lists. And then the thing that's, I think, very useful about this is we have a mandate to then somehow make this public. So we had a really big team written document that that was published in 2024, December of 2024 in the Plant Genome. So anybody can go, anybody in the world with the internet access can go and look this thing up, and they can read about what we think the accomplishments, key accomplishments and priorities are in recent years, and where we think the community is going. And so one other thing we did this year, which was, I think maybe we kind of, during discussions, realized that it was an area of importance, but we hadn't formed a group to really discuss it specifically, but it was to specifically talk about how we're going to train the next generation of scientists in this field, and how we were going to, what funding opportunities might be out there for this, for training and developing young scientists. And I thought that ended up being, at the end of the day, we put it in its own section of the document because we thought it was an important enough area of emphasis. So anyway, it's a good snapshot of where the community stands at a given point in time, and also tries to put this forward-looking direction towards the community so we can go to granting agencies and say things like, you know, the soybean community has identified this as an area of priority. You know, it helps to strengthen the argument to perhaps fund the work that we're trying to emphasize and prioritize as well. So that's, I guess, the big picture of what we were trying to do accomplish.
Fantastic. No, it's really interesting because I don't know how many other disciplines have that level of structure around, summarizing previous year's findings and also thinking of a vision for the upcoming years. So this is really, really interesting, really, really nice to know that it does exist in this case for plant genetics and genomics.
Yeah. And in the case of the soybean genomics plan, I think the first one was written in the mid-1990s. So these things have been coming out periodically for quite some time. And it's interesting if you can find it online. You can find some of the older documents to see where the community was at these different stages of the whole, you know, revolution and all these new technologies that were coming along. And it's pretty amazing, and it's even somewhat humbling to read and think about that and say, okay, well, what is our document going to look like in 10 or 15 or 20 years? Will we have identified the right priorities, or were we behind the times and missed something? You know, it's something to think about.
That's really cool. So perhaps something that can come out of that is what, you know, perhaps based on the work of the committee or maybe based on your own specific work of your lab, but what do you see as soybean genomics looking like in the future, perhaps in the next 5 years, perhaps, you know, longer than that? But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a super question. I think there's a few areas that come immediately to mind. First is, I think the ability to use genomic information to improve selection and prediction of breeding populations is going to get better and better. And I say this both for sort of what we think of as major effect loci and also for maybe minor effect loci as well, which means, you know, even regions of the genome that just have a small effect on phenotype might be easier to identify or become more accessible to identification and use and utility. So I think that's one area where I'm interested to see how good we get at predicting quantitative traits like yield, seed composition, drought resistance, things like that. Like how good how far can we push genomics in the direction of effective selection and aiding selection to make these things go faster and better? I think also it's going to be interesting to see how much we learn about the direct function of genes and whether or not we can find ways to use them, using these new biotechnologies like gene editing. Can we find ways to make that effective and accessible to, you know, different applications? So I think those are the two things that I'm really keeping my eye on and into the future to see how effective the community becomes at those types of applications.
Nice. Fantastic. Well, thanks for sharing that. We're getting towards the latter part of our episode here. And before we do that, I just want to call out our audience and, you know, ask if you're enjoying this episode, make sure to drop us a like, follow us, subscribe to our channels here, and also make sure to share this great conversation here with anyone you think may benefit from it.
It's time for our famous three.
WiseNetX turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access WiseNetX.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
All right, Bob. So now we get to the last three questions that we ask every guest. And so the first one here is, would you have any resource that you have found to be useful for you that is related to your technical expertise?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've been thinking a little bit about that, and I've come to the rather sour conclusion that I'm not sure I can recommend a single resource that the one resource I use probably more than any other in my everyday work is the Phytosome website. And soy-based. Those are the two I would say. So there's a great online tools if you want to study soybean and understand soybean genomes or any plant genome. So like Phytosome keeps a catalog of different maps of genomes and where the genes are and things like that. And so we can go in and you can look at the different versions of soybean genomes and try to learn what those genes do. And it's the kind of thing that we do all the time. It's sort of that base and that reference for our ability to discover diversity in the species. And I also mentioned Soybase. It's a database maintained by the USDA. And they have all kinds of tools in there that are great for both breeders and genomicists who are interested in working on soybean. So I would say Phytosome and Soybase are probably I'm saying that too quickly. Soybase is just soybase.org, and then Phytosome is just Phytosome. So you can Google those and find those resources online quite easily. I would say those are. But the other thing, of course, is the primary literature. I mean, this field moves very fast, and it's any book or even any paper that's written has a fairly short shelf life in terms of the technologies that are used. As the technologies change, our ability to answer and ask questions changes quite a bit. So keeping up with there's really, as a practicing scientist, there's no real substitute for just trying to keep up with the primary literature.
That's very true. And so, just so I follow up, so Phytosome and Soybase, are those available to anyone, or do you have to have some type of affiliation to access them?
Yeah, it's. I'm pretty sure they're entirely public and accessible to anyone.
Nice.
So yeah, if anyone has trouble finding those, you know, you can send me a email complaining that my reference didn't work, but it should be fine. It should be fine. And there's some curators that you can contact at those databases too if you have specific questions.
This is great. And, you know, you never know, maybe somebody in our audience is just starting to study, you know, plant breeding genomics and genetics, and maybe they run into this resource and find it very exciting. And perhaps they go down that path of also becoming a plant breeder, right? So we'll never know how this information will be used and what will lead to. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Bob, for sharing that. Our second question of the three here is very similar in terms of a resource you found useful, however, outside of your technical area of expertise.
There's a million ways to answer this. I would say probably the thing that I find outside of the media, if I'm really looking for like inspiration or understanding, I'm very interested in the history of science, and I'm actually just interested in history and more generally. And so I do read quite a few nonfiction books on that sort of cover the biography of people that sort of created and developed these fields that I'm interested in. So there are a few books that I've read recently that I think I would recommend. One is called The Wizard and the Prophet. It's written by Charles Mann. And it tells the story of two sort of mid-20th century scientists who were had different ways of seeing the world, and it influenced the type of work they did. And so one was actually a graduate of the University of Minnesota, who's quite well-known here, Norman Borlaug. He's sort of the wizard. He was the plant very famous plant breeder who worked with primarily with wheat and short-stature wheat that became sort of grown around the world. And then they contrast his life and career with a man named William Vogt, who is the prophet, who is more of a conservationist, didn't really want to do the technology-based solutions, was more into the conservation-based look. And so that perspective is interesting to compare. And I think it challenges the reader to think about where they sort of sit on the wizard versus prophet spectrum. And sometimes I see, oh, I'm a little bit of each, and depending on an issue or thing I'm interested in. And another one that I would recommend real quickly is called The Food Explorer. It's written by Daniel Stone. And it talks about some of the early exploration of different useful plant species that was done in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And so they really focus a lot on somebody named David Fairchild, another person named Frank Meyer, who did a lot of actual, literally, this is before, you know, world travel was common. It was very hard to do, but they found ways to go around the world and try to collect species, oftentimes just on foot, you know, walking through areas of the world and trying to find things that might be good to bring back to the U.S. and try to introduce for farmers. And so I thought that was a really fascinating story, just the biography of what they did. And I think both these books I'm really interested in, because just to look at the level of passion that all these people had for what they were doing, and really a lot of the sacrifices they made to follow that passion. I think it's really, like I say, it's quite inspirational. It's and it's just very interesting to think about how the world worked back then and some of the limitations they faced and how they tried to overcome those. It's very interesting.
Great, great, great answer. And just want to make sure I got this right also for our audience, if they want to follow up. So you said The Wizard and the Prophet, is that the first one?
Yes, I said that right. The Wizard and the Prophet, Charles Mann is the author.
Charles Mann. Yep. And then the second one was Food Explorer by Daniel Stone. Is that right?
Yep, correct.
Perfect. Nice. No, that's amazing. Thanks for sharing that. And then our last of the three questions is, in your opinion, in your experience, what have been the skills or skill set that you've observed on successful professionals?
Yeah, well, of course, there's many. You know, many years ago, I remember my dad told me, he said, when you hire somebody, you only really look for three things. And I'm trying to remember what they are now. I think, you know, are they bright? Are they hardworking? And are they honest? And I think those are a great place to start. Assuming that you are those things and you strive to be those things, the other thing I would say that I would add to the list, which is a really important feature, is especially nowadays, is being a reliable and good communicator. And what I mean by that is, you know, do you answer your email? Are you prompt about getting drafts back to your collaborators? Because I feel like, at least in my profession, you know, where I am, and probably I'm assuming where you are as well, there's a lot of collaborative research, and it's really easy for a project to shut down by just not participants not communicating often enough, or you know, showing that they're staying involved in the project and thinking about it. So sometimes it's hard to coordinate and make sure that communication is good, but it's really good if people are naturally like to communicate and want to communicate. And the other thing is to be a finisher. You know, I've seen over the years, I've seen with lots of just my interactions with students and postdocs, and this applies to myself as well. You know, it's really easy to start projects. It's really easy to have a new idea in many ways. It's really hard to see that idea through and to finish the project, because a lot of times it seems a lot more exciting at the start than it does at the finish. And just keeping up that motivation, you have to really almost be intentional about saying, I'm going to finish this because it's important and you know, the outcomes are valuable. It's just not as exciting anymore because it's an older idea now. So yeah, I would say communication and willingness to finish are really great traits to have.
That was such a great advice. I definitely agree with all of those, really. But especially the finisher one is a good reminder, right? Especially, I don't know how you organize your teaching appointment. I also have a teaching appointment, and I teach two courses per year, and I concentrate them in the spring semester, which goes from January through May. So this time is harder to be a finisher on the research side because it's so focused on the teaching, but it's still trying to make progress on both sides.
That's a great point, though. You know, there's a lot of seasonality to this, right? There's the field season, and then there's the, you know, when am I going to have time to actually analyze my data? When am I going to have time to write this up? You know, these are real challenges, I'd say. And they're behavioral challenges that can be overcome, but you've got to be intentional about it sometimes. Yeah.
Nice. Well, with that, we wrap up our episode. Bob, thank you so much for being here with us today. I really enjoyed our conversation. Really, you know, was reminded of some concepts that I have forgotten probably, and learned a lot of new concepts here as well with you. So I really enjoyed all of your knowledge and expertise around genomics in soybeans.
Well, thanks so much, Leonardo. I really appreciate you bringing me on. And yeah, like I say, anyone out there who's listening, if you have questions or comments, you know, feel free to reach out to us, and we'll do our best to try to help you out.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.